Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik, and my guest today is Daniel Cavan, who is the author of The Architecture of Normal, which is a very substantial pictorial essay and a philosophical essay, I think, on what has sort of happened to the region of the country we call the Intermountain West and the historical precedents for architecture there and some of the interventions, shall we say, of the motorized era, which have perhaps not done it any favors. Welcome aboard.
Hi, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So, the architecture of normal, what does the title mean to you, and how did you come about the idea for this book?
So the extended title is, Architecture of Normal, the Colonization of the American Landscape. And, in a nutshell, it's about the evolution of architecture in America as propelled by transportation advances. So the book is broken up into a couple kind of major components throughout history: humans, horses, trains, cars, planes, rockets. Rockets being, sort of a look to the future. And the book came about in, around my 40th birthday. I did what I would maybe describe as sort of a vision quest, where I just got in a car and drove a really long way from Los Angeles to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I'm from. And really, and I took a very long path through there, driving through the Navajo Reservation and a lot of rural roads. And some of it is, just a sort of searching for what was and what could be. And I took a lot of photographs and thought about it a lot and just started writing a bit. And, not in the beginning when I was writing it, wasn't really a book per se that I was wanting to write or publish. It was more like musings or things that influenced me or things that I was creating art from. And then, as that project kind of progressed, there was something there, and then something that people were increasingly interested in. And that's how the book came about.
Very cool. And in addition to being a writer, of course, you're an architect and a visual artist. Can you talk a little bit about how you found your way into those things, and how they intersect and find form in this book?
Yeah, so I, from a young age, always wanted to be an architect, and I went to architecture school straight out of high school. Well, straight out, I mean, I took a little time off and then I went to architecture school. But, and along the way, I've, always made films, painted, did photography, and a lot of other artistic activities in addition to architecture. And increasingly, those things are kind of melding together in my life. And in the book in particular, there's a lot of drawings that I did, illustrations, work that I did with photography from, my journey and historical resources and drawings on top of that. And so it's sort of this multi-layered collage throughout the book of the history of the American West and the architecture that keeps popping up.
Indeed, it does. And that's obviously an area with a lot of lyrical possibilities. I've spent a fair amount of time in New Mexico, and frankly, everyone that I've met who's from there or has gone to school there is just the coolest person I've ever met. So there's something in the water. It really is the land of enchantment, but then it also sort of has some of the scuzziest strip malls and commercial architecture I've ever seen. So, like, to have that as the background, and then to be compounded by the imagery that we've now all seen, you know, through Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, we have this impression that seems very sort of stuck of what it is. But I think you've opened up a few new avenues, or shall we say old avenues of discovery about the history of the place. What made you sort of wanted to center it in New Mexico? I mean, obviously you're from there.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, only very recently have I currently live in Portland, Oregon, and only recently have I actually lived outside of New Mexico longer than I had resided inside New Mexico. So my soul is there, you know, in many ways, and, you know, much of my formative memory is there. And it's something, it's like a resource that I continue to tap creatively throughout my life. And, you know, also kind of a source of brain damage in a way. Ironically, you mentioned Breaking Bad, which I've watched a couple episodes and think it's an amazing show, but I just can't fully jump into it because there is just kind of a lot of Albuquerque in that show that, you know, are places and old haunts and things like that. And it's just like, you know, kind of the worst of Albuquerque all wrapped up into one box. And, you know, the irony behind what is uninspiring about Albuquerque or New Mexico at large is that's really true across America. I mean, this new America of suburban strip malls, walled in housing developments, you know, big parking lots surrounding big box stores and, you know, gingerbread strip malls. It's really, I mean, you can find it anywhere. And, you know, that's one of the focuses of the introduction to my book is talking about how you can be in a Home Depot in different states and find things on the same aisle in the same place that look exactly the same. And it's depressing.
It is actually. I think something about the seeing the sameness of that type of commercial architecture applied against the backdrop of a landscape that's so haunting and so, you know, inspiring and beautiful as New Mexico. I think it makes people sad. I think they're struck by the irony of it. And so it seems like, in some ways, the best place to sort of study it, because if you don't have that backdrop, it's the contrast is not quite as significant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my career, it's interesting because my architectural career is very much focused on, you know, kind of two things, either urban infill kind of projects. We do a lot of those. And then, you know, fancy single family residences, you know, and these are one-off things, not spec houses, or not tract houses, I should say. And then my art is very much fueled by, you know, the seedier side of architecture and design, the ubiquitousness of the West, the things that are not attractive. And I mean, you can see that in the illustration in the book too. That's definitely what I focus on there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, you're in a position of being able to present an informed critique, which is highly visual. And then at the same time, you know, your day job, as it were, is to try to improve the physical environment. Mm-hmm. Do you ever find, like, I can't imagine you're walking around with this book when you're going to a client pitch, but do you ever find a situation where you're able to use your art that's meant as critique to kind of indicate what you don't want to do or what you would like to what direction you'd like to go with your clients? Is there just a Chinese wall between the two?
Well, there's kind of a merging of the two in sort of how, you know, I display my art. Like increasingly I'm doing projects in which, you know, I'm doing a mural inside the building and things like that, or I want to do an installation inside the house that I'm designing that will be permanent. But my art per se is much more narrative in some ways, and the world in which we live in is the stage for it, versus using the stage of the world I've designed is the stage for it. So that's kind of the difference there.
That's a good way of putting it. I've seen, you know, sort of surrealist, large scale art. You know, I'm thinking of things like Andreas Gorky and the gentleman who was Ed Ruscha, who did the Sunset Boulevard retrospective. And it reminded me a little bit of those things.
Ed Ruscha, he's a huge influence of mine. I mean, so there would be some of that there. Yeah. I mean, he's a huge influence, and, you know, even down to color, you know, the colors of that I use in my art are, you know, loud, and they're, you know, sort of like you'd imagine a strip mall in Las Vegas to be, and punchy. And then my architecture is very muted and based on, you know, natural materials. And there's a lot of grays and blacks and muted colors. Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, it was fun to kind of, you know, be in those two worlds in the book. I've got the book here and I'm just kind of glancing at it. You know, I don't know if you have it in front of you, but the book itself is very bright and colorful, and it is representative of the West itself. And just, you know, I'm impressed that you did read the whole book, because it is almost 500 pages.
I try to be thorough in my research, although I don't know that I have a page by page kind of blow by blow for you.
Sure.
But
I don't either.
I did think that the organization was kind of interesting, where I completely understand the organization of modes of transit, you know, going from humans, horses, trains, mm-hmm. cars, airplanes, rockets. And then you have a couple of bounds around that. You start with I-25, which is the interstate that runs north to south through New Mexico and Colorado and a couple of the other mountain states. And then the next chapter is called Indian Plaza, which mm-hmm. I think was the name of your local strip mall, right? For local
yeah.
development.
Yes.
And then you end with Cibola.
Yeah.
So what is that about? Because that's kind of mysterious.
So Cibola is the sort of the imaginary city that the Spanish were looking for when they came into New Mexico. It was part of the Seven Cities of Gold. And it, you know, it's really the discovery of America for the most part. I mean, it's interesting that Columbus is even attributed with finding America for the Europeans, is that, you know, he didn't even actually set foot in what we would consider America proper these days. And the Vikings were there far, far before. But the Spanish, you know, they came in through Mexico and, you know, they actually occupied territory in the United States. And that's, you know, really where the first battles were fought. But Cibola is sort of this concept of, you know, looking ahead towards the future, trying to find something. And then, you know, that's why I named it the last chapter. And, you know, what is it that we're looking for? And, you know, it was interesting, you know, I actually finished the book in COVID, and there was a couple small pieces that I rewrote because of current circumstances. And COVID has really, I would say, sped up some of what I was imagining would happen. And the major thing is moving from a experiential lifestyle to a destination-based life, where, you know, I mean, one of the most important concepts here is, if you could imagine a Route 66 or a Main Street America in any town America in 1955 to 65, you would be seeing lots of signs and lots of people cruising around and pulling over and talking to people and meeting people. And now, really, that whole experience is in social media. So an Instagram feed is really akin to a Main Street America, where you're just scrolling through and finding things and meeting people and seeing signs and all of those things. And you really, people are choosing where they want to go. And they're basically, you know, through that experience, through recommendations in that experience, and then, or a map where they're finding the best restaurant, and they're really just searching for that and going from point A to point B, and everything in between is, you know, becoming this gray area that people don't seem to care a whole lot about. And increasingly with autonomous cars and, you know, I start talking about flying cars, you know, that's going to get even worse, because the other thing that's going to happen is, as soon as we have fully autonomous cars and flying cars, people are just going to get into those things and get on their phones again and not even look outside. And, you know, if you're flying, you're just in the sky and it all looks the same anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, definitely, certainly the commercial strip of the 50s and 60s has been accused of killing off Main Street, but it may actually be social media that deals the final blow. Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. It's almost a progression of the same sort of dispersal and atomization, I think, of people's lives. And yeah, the idea of flying vehicles is kind of terrifying, especially when you consider how poorly people drive to begin with, and autonomous cars haven't worked out so well just yet.
Yeah, so I have some pretty specific views on that. I mean, so I saw just in the news today that what company was it? One of the airlines just bought a bunch of air taxis from this company, Archer, today, or they just ordered 100 of them. I mean, this is really happening. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, to wrap your head around is there were essentially no cars in 1900. And then, you know, by 1920, there was an unreal amount of cars. And, you know, that happened so fast. I mean, in fact, Henry Ford had a whole department at Ford devoted to, you know, flying personal cars. He thought it was going to happen in his lifetime. And it didn't. But one of the things to wrap your head around is that autonomous cars are really, really complicated to get going. I mean, we have thousands of governmental agencies that have to be involved in approving that. We have really complicated, you know, things all over the place to run into, inconsistency and signs and, you know, rules and things like that across state lines. But for the flying aircraft, all of the skies are controlled by one body and one government. And largely, planes fly autonomously for the most part also, you know, except for takeoff and landing. And we're not going to have, and they have the advantage of having the Z axis. So on the ground, you know, you have an XY axis and you can't fly things over one another. And there's no obstacles in the sky except birds and other, you know, flying objects. And there's already a centralized way to deal with those things. So, I think it's likely that the only barrier is financial. So as soon as you can get your own personal flying plane for $100,000, I mean, it's really going to take off.
Yeah, and it's not difficult to picture the sky being full of those. And of course, before the prices come down, it will be mostly the Elon Musks and the wannabe Elon Musks of the world doing whatever they please in the skies, hovering over whatever they want to hover over. And yeah, what does that mean for the built environment? What does it mean for, just something as simple as signage, just to get your
It
attention, a happenstance.
means a lot. It's going to be the major transformer. I mean, that's kind of what I see is, we had the humans, and then we had the horsepower, and then the trains. And I mean, and that's what my book is about, is like how these things affected the evolution of our cities and towns. And the next thing, it will absolutely be flying cars. And I actually think it will most likely happen in, someplace like Saudi Arabia, someplace that's, really warm on technology right now, who has a government that can kind of unilaterally make decisions in an authoritative, fast kind of way. I mean, they love technology like that. And the other thing is, in environments that are, really hot, places that where people don't want to be outside a whole lot anyway, they don't really have a city and walking culture because, everything's already indoor. But it's going to have huge ramifications for cities. And I mean, one of the things that we're already seeing right now is the struggle in the existing infrastructure of cities with retail. Amazon has just totally turned retail, or the Amazonization of the world. It's not just Amazon, but delivery retail is turning cities on their heads, and we don't have retail on the ground floor of buildings the same way that we used to. I mean, I'm seeing that looking out my window right now and seeing how that has affected things. And we need to really consider, do we want to live in cities that don't have functioning businesses in the bottom of the buildings? I mean, it will not having activity on the streets, is going to really change things.
Yeah, it would be pretty alienating. I mean, and of course, I'm sure you've seen, some of the images that have been released of things like the line, Neom in Saudi Arabia, where the just sidling up at the bar of technology and saying, "Pour me a second and a third and a fourth, and I'll just go ahead and apply that to the landscape, regardless of what relationship it has to the landscape." Already, you're seeing, plausible, if not advisable, structures being designed to have like literally no relationship to the ground.
Yeah, I mean the ramifications for, I mean, it is not in the far off future to have to be designing cities and infrastructure in which the movement of humans is in the air on top of the buildings and not on the ground floor. And which, really makes the difference between the socioeconomic status of people important. It's like there's the private jet air dwellers, and there's the grounds people, the people that can't afford to fly around, and you can't even land on a building that you don't have membership in.
It's not difficult to picture that kind of stratification becoming almost literal strata in the sense of the ground dwellers, who may be subject to, flooding or whatever else is crawling around down there, and
Trash.
it's 190 degrees outside, and different strata of society get to live higher up, literally up into the stratosphere. I mean, this is something that we have to reconcile with, and it's something that we talk about all the time at my day job, which is, the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. We are constantly asked questions about this, like can people live this way, and we've always sort of made the argument of, yes, you can, but should you?
Yes.
You know, we don't necessarily advocate that we should just always go taller and always have buildings that are more isolating and more reflective and more autonomous. You know, we very much push for integrated vertical cities. And I definitely think, you know, having access to people, having access for people who are pedestrians at different levels of these mega structures is really important. And not just access, but vitality. Yeah. And I don't know how you achieve that if everyone is flying around in single use, you know, AirPods.
Yeah. I mean, if there's any moral of my book, it's that just because we have the technology to do something doesn't necessarily mean we should do it. I mean, that if you just look to history, you know, it's full of these instances of these brilliant people who team up in groups and, you know, they're scientists and inventors and, you know, they just get a kick out of solving problems and they just want to, you know, figure out how to make light work, you know, in a dark room and things like that. Or, you know, they just want to make a horseless carriage, a carriage that can propel itself, you know, and they're not necessarily solving those problems to make money. But then when the technology exists, you know, it can do things that have unforeseen ramifications. I mean, I think the most threatening right now are things to do with artificial intelligence and, you know, biotech related stuff, but also drone technology. I mean, you know, we have to reckon with, do we want to all live in places where we don't go out and shop and we just order stuff online and it gets delivered to a little drone pad in our yard or, you know, at our window? I mean, these companies are investing hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, into this technology. I mean, they are making it happen.
What's interesting to me too is that they seem to be hedging their bets. You know, I mean, there are also a lot of investments in physical infrastructure, even in the traditional kind. You could even say traditionalist. I mean, some of the biggest buyers of commercial real estate or lessors of commercial real estate have been companies like Amazon and Google in recent years. I mean, partially it's because they have the money and real estate is usually a good investment, but they must at some point fundamentally believe something about the attractiveness of cities and urban life if they're going to pour all this money into, you know, building a new headquarters for Amazon or Google just buying the old State of Illinois Thompson Center building here in downtown Chicago. It's ironic that they're doing that at the same time that they are also developing these technologies that increase the speed of anomie and atomization that we already experience.
Yeah, I mean, these companies are nation states. I mean, they, you know, the value of a Google or a Tesla or an Apple is larger than many, many countries in the world. And, you know, increasingly as we break down borders with, you know, rockets and things like that, it's going to become an even blurrier line. And, you know, I guess that's a little outside the box of what you're suggesting with real estate, but real estate is power. I mean, it's physical space, you know, it's ownership. I mean, I'm surprised we haven't already seen like a Tesla say that, you know, we're actually going to move our headquarters to this, you know, island that we just bought and that's where our headquarters is and we're going to operate from there. And all these other things are just satellite businesses. I mean, it's, or somebody that basically teams up with an authoritarian regime that can also do that, that who's saying, yeah, we'll come be part of this country.
So I think seeing the, clearly the, you have a very strong critique of what's been done to the landscape of, you know, your of your home. Are there any trends that you're seeing in the, let's call it the Intermountain West, that are positive, or that you see, you know, people building something that's more redemptive on the landscape as opposed to just either exploiting it for rocket launching pads or building endless suburbia onto the fringes?
Well, I would say, you know, we had a 20-year run from, you know, probably the early 90s. I mean, maybe almost all the way up to COVID of, I would say, a re-urbanization of many cities in the West where, you know, people, I mean, particularly cities like Portland really doubled down on the downtown and built a lot of new urban things, and people wanted to still be able to walk places. I mean, but COVID has been really challenging. It's really challenged that, you know, a lot of people, or, you know, any, you know, it, anyone who is living in apartments that, you know, necessarily wasn't somebody that really embraced the urban lifestyle a whole lot, but was there doing it for financial reasons. Those people have rethought it, and, you know, they're wanting to live in bigger houses and with more space and phone in to work. And that's, I think, really reshaping the landscape. I mean, the most explosive growth I've seen anytime lately is in Boise, Idaho, particularly in the suburban areas. And I mean, it is massive farmlands getting torn up to put down walled in housing communities and then, you know, strip mall nodes with big box anchors. And that is largely where I think the West is getting built out right now. But you're seeing, you know, you are seeing a resurgence in New York City and places like that, you know, with a lot of people wanting to live in buildings. You know, rent has gone way up in cities like that, and rent's gone up here in Portland. But, you know, I think, you know, people are very, and this goes back to your, you know, your big building stuff. COVID's been very hard on big buildings because, you know, we're still not even over, you know, all these viruses and things like that. And the idea of people living on the 80th floor of a building and having to go through an elevator with jammed up with five people every day, you know, it's, I think, a challenge. And it's a challenge for investors and banks and things like that to get their heads wrapped around it.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, you know, you mentioned Boise. I'll put an article link in the show notes I had seen in the Wall Street Journal. Even that is no longer a cheap bonanza. You know, the land rush has already taken effect, and a lot of people are already feeling like they're too late to get their so-called Zoomtown dream home. You know, one hopes that, you know, as some of these cities realize that the lifestyle that they are predicating their, you know, come build your Zoom office and your ante room and your accessory dwelling unit, you know, here instead of, you know, paying New York City or San Francisco rents, they might not be able to hold on to that proposition if they're not smart about how they allocate land. So that doesn't, it sort of feels like, yeah, Boomtown, Zoomtown is a pretty good analogy right now.
Yeah. And I mean, the Boomtown came, I mean, it's, that has a history in America. You know, you saw these cities, you know, boom out of nowhere in West Texas and things like that in the early part of the 20th century when they, you know, discovered oil here and there. And, you know, they're just nothing towns now. I mean, the expansion of the West was essentially a big land deal where, you know, the US government loaned the train barons money to build the train tracks, and then they paid it back by, you know, they were given the land wherever they put a train depot, and then they sold the land largely to European settlers that, you know, wanted to come, you know, own something in America. And that's how they paid back the U.S. government. And if you go to these places now, like a Hobbs, New Mexico, I mean, Albuquerque was a train town also, but, you know, Hobbs would be a great example of one of these places that, you know, doesn't have any of the boom in the boom town anymore. So we shall see. I don't foresee, I mean, a Boise, Idaho has a lot of other things going for it. You know, it's not just out in the middle of the desert without any other resources. But it'll be interesting to see when the economy does make some sharp turns, how these exurban housing developments do in that case. So the big thing here is if, you know, everyone's really going to be able to do their job on a computer from their house or not. And I think it definitely has some challenges.
A lot of the, you know, large office-based organizations like Goldman Sachs and other financial institutions are struggling with this because while it isn't strictly necessary for people to be at their desks in order to operate the computer and get onto the network, things like succession planning and mentoring and bringing people into the culture of a company, to the extent that that's even a good thing, some of these companies, as you say, are like nation states in and of themselves and could have a cultish quality that perhaps would be best allayed. But even so, I mean, there's no chance to create a real camaraderie, I think, around a totally dispersed workforce that never gets together.
No, I think, I mean, in my mind, Generation Z needs to get out in the streets and be really pissed off about work from home. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of people graduating from college and things like that are like, this is great. Like, you know, I don't have to go into the office. But as, I mean, you can't learn and get to know people and build relationships on Zoom calls. I mean, I just don't think it's possible. And you also can't, I mean, the other advantages of being in real work environments and around other people is that you learn what you like and you don't like. Like, you don't like your job, but, oh man, that guy over there, like that guy, that they do the coolest stuff ever. I want to do what that person does. But, you know, let me take a moment to put in my two cents on this related to architecture, where I feel like architects need to be really leading the charge here. Like, our business is building in real life environments. I mean, that is the entire purpose of what we do, is we make beautiful spaces for people to live and work. And in our own business, we need to make that the model for what we do. And I see a lot of people phoning that in now, where, you know, architecture firms have had a lot of pressure of, you know, people want to do their job at their house and just come in a little bit. But that's not what we do. Like, we make meeting spaces, we make gathering spaces, we make informal open workspaces where people can collaborate and do things. The tech companies there, I mean, it's interesting too, because you see the Twitters and the Googles and the Facebooks and the Airbnbs. They're like, you can work from anywhere. We'll accommodate whoever. But all of their business models, you know, make more money from that. They can throw their weight around, like a Facebook, you know. Those are huge companies, and they are throwing their weight around, and they're going to be like, we pay lots of money and you can work from home. And as that radiates out through the cult, you know, our work environment, it's harder and harder for other companies to compete with that, because anybody can go to work for Google or Facebook and make a lot of money and work from home. And so they're setting the tone, right? And Facebook's out there creating the metaverse. You know, it's like they want to put our whole world in a box, You know, they want it. They just want you to like stick your whole head in a screen and live in there.
Yeah, and if you've seen some of the architecture of the metaverse that's been proposed so far, it's not very promising.
No, it's horrible. Well, the other thing that I thought I was like, oh, this is, you know, I mean, as a general note, I would say that architects are very underpaid and appreciated for what we do and what we bring to our everyday world. But I was like, man, I mean, this is where architects are just going to kill it, because we also, I mean, everything that we design is virtual before it's real. And so we're really good at that. But I've been shocked by, you know, kind of what has been built out. It just looks like a dorky video game.
Yeah. And then the activities that they plan for this, like, I'm virtually shopping in Walmart. That's really the best you can do. Like that's the future that is in store for all of us, with all of these tech wizards putting their giant noggins together.
Yeah. I mean, there is no future with goggles on. I'll tell you that. So the future is definitely in the augmented reality, not in the, you know, the virtual reality, I think. I mean, getting your mom or, you know, to like put on goggles and live in the metaverse in a, you know, Eames lounge chair, I just think is unlikely.
Indeed. Well, I wonder if you do have a near term, you know, future prediction or something that you're anticipating after having processed all this history. You know, if you wanted to, let's put it this way, if you wanted to start the journey again, to that resulted in the production of this book, what might you include or not include or do differently?
Well, I'm not sure I would do any of the book differently. I guess I have learned a lot throughout this process. And I think what is great about the book is everything that I've learned is in the book. And I kind of wrote it as sixth grade history. Like, and I have a sixth grader and he's read the book, or read most of it anyway. But there's so many things in here I feel like just everyone should know. I mean, there's a lot of just basic history. You know, it draws a line throughout the history of America. And I think it would be really informative and helpful for people to read the book. And it's a fast read for the most part. But if you're asking me, I think what I got from the book that I can apply to the future, you know, I think the big thing is we need to not rip America apart and, you know, sort of say we're doing it all wrong and just start over, you know, with the metaverse, or, you know, now we're going to, you know, not do cities anymore. We're going to, you know, build everything as a suburban housing development. I mean, you know, I think Portland in particular was, you know, really on the right path of building large scale public transportation and big, you know, relatively large buildings and things like that. And, you know, I'm a huge proponent of it. I'm a huge proponent of the focus on cities and architecture that people walk around on. Walking is a great way to, you know, stay healthy, to socialize, to interact with people. And getting out of, I mean, cars are really cool. Planes are really cool. Flying cars are really cool. I think all those things potentially have a place. We just need to keep the focus on walking and keeping things dense. And I think figuring out how people can live a more spacious life in a more urban environment. Like, for instance, in the post-war, right after World War II, there was a lot of apartments that were built in New York City that, you know, were 2 and 3 bedroom, you know, pretty large scale apartments with normal size rooms. And the latest development, the latest craze, like in a apartment development on the West Coast, are micro units, things that are, you know, so small. They're like the size of tiny hotel rooms. And, you know, I don't think that's where you get people to get excited about living in cities. You know, it's like, how do we figure out how to put single family size houses in huge towers? You know, that's in my mind more the goal of, you know, how we can be successful for the planet and for society.
And interestingly, people have had that vision for a long time, and not only executed it in places like New York, but, you know, the experimental architectures of the late 60s, like Moshe Safdie, mm-hmm. tried to answer that specific question. You know, they saw what was happening, you know, the suburbanization, the picture windows, and the need for everything to, the framed view to be like the view that you were seeing through your television screen. And, you know, they were trying to figure out how to get the properties that people really appreciated about a little bit of space for themselves, a little bit of outdoor space, into these vertical environments. And you do see some success with that, but not so much in the United States and North America. You see it in places that are more like Singapore and tropical parts of Asia, mm-hmm. Where people are probably a little bit more accustomed to communal living. But that's also sort of not giving ourselves, North Americans, enough credit for how recently we did do those things. It's just that the speed of technology, I think, has probably made us forget things.
Part of it is just the availability of land. I mean, it's, you know, as a developer, it's really difficult to justify, you know, building these huge towers when, you know, there's just so much cheap land around to spread things out. But one of my huge frustrations, one of the things I think is we're going to regret in this era is, and part of this has to do with, or most of it has to do with, the zoning that's been created, like in cities like Portland, where everyone's decided that, you know, buildings shouldn't be taller than about 65 feet, you know, that, you know, cities like Paris and things like that are, you know, dense and beautiful and have, you know, smaller buildings. And so in the, you know, per the building code, all those end up being is, you know, these dorky 5-1 wood framed buildings with cheap materials on it. And they're just built all over the West Coast, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco. There's just a ton of them. And they're a cheap way to get apartments built. But, you know, cities like Paris, it's like they have stone facades and terracotta and, you know, these beautiful building materials that last centuries. And we're just doing none of that. And the age on and patina on these buildings is not going to work well.
No. I mean, yeah, if I could cross out 95% of the 5-1 developments I've seen, I would do so. I would unsee them. It's definitely just because the form factor is the same. If the finishes and the treatment and the context are not the same, you're not going to have a Parisian effect just because you've affected the same, you know, figure ground ratio.
That's where I think taller buildings come into play, is just, you know, when you get the economy of scale of a much larger building, and the building code will force you to do a type one type building that is of a much higher fire rating and quality, and you're going to end up with much more resilient building materials all around. And it's going to last longer too, and it's going to look better in the urban environment. So, I mean, I think the emphasis has got to be on building higher quality buildings, and then, you know, much faster.
Indeed. Well, we're almost out of time, and I'm trying to think if there's a wrap up kind of. Manifest destiny kind of phrase, like go west, that we can say about the near future to kind of tie it together. I was sort of thinking you know, write code, but not the kind of code that Google wants you to write, but, you know, urban design code. Maybe that's the manifest destiny of the next few decades of the 21st century.
Let me read. There's one paragraph in the last part of the introduction to my book that I think sums up a lot here. Albuquerque, and this is sort of based on the chapter that kind of focuses on the evolution of Albuquerque. Albuquerque, as she stands today, is a remnant of America's enduring drive to be first and win at all costs. The supremacy of Cornelius Vanderbilt, Henry Ford, and the Wright brothers is manifest block by block and street by street in Albuquerque, and effectively the entire West. Ultimately, these mavericks of technology and transportation did not slice and dice America into the state she is in today. They created only the machines that would sew the urban, suburban, and exurban fabric into being. There was no pattern nor blueprint for how these planes, trains, and automobiles should operate in society, or how they would connect our expansive landscape. In the spirit of America, the West would be designed and executed on the fly as fast as the latest and greatest technology could move. Transportation and its architects colonized the West, and then the infrastructure consumed it whole.
An excerpt from The Architecture of Normal by Daniel Kaven. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate it.